Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel on the historic day, May 2nd. Thanks for joining us here at Baseball America or on iTunes, wherever you download the podcast. And Aaron, you were the one who clued me in. Clueless John over here, sitting there watching some NBA highlights and watching the Phillies-Mets game. And I flipped off the TV and came upstairs to check on college baseball. And you were the one on IM who gave me the Bin Laden news. So that was... just another, I'll always think of you when I think of that historic event. So slightly less historic weekend in college baseball, but we are here to talk a little college baseball, Fitzy, and let's just go jump right into it with the game that you went to on Friday night, Aaron, and the Pac-10. Let's just jump right into the Pacific 10 Conference. Oregon State stays number 3. No change in the top 5 in our rankings this week, Aaron. Virginia 1, South Carolina 2. Oregon State 3, Vanderbilt 4, Florida 5. No real surprise there, except for the fact that Oregon State went on the road, Aaron, and did what I think we never thought teams would do this year, which is go on the road and beat Gerrit Cole and Trevor Bauer back-to-back. What'd you see out of Oregon State? What are people going to read a little bit of? You can tease a little bit for what people are going to read in three strikes today. How have the Oregon State Beavers continued to stay this hot and to lead the Pac-10? Despite the loss of Andrew Susak, their probable first-round pick catcher?
You know, they really play hard. It's can't help but be reminded of that, you know, 2017. I mean, the Oregon State built a dynasty in the last decade because of their toughness and their, you know, just their every time they took the field, they had a mental edge over their opponents. And this team feels that way, you know. They they always believe they're going to win. You know, you ask them, when are the injuries going to catch up with you guys? And, you know, the players just don't believe that's going to happen. I mean, they really are a confident group. I'm almost at a loss for words. It's just really impressive what they've been able to do.
I mean, it's amazing. Offensively, you look at them, Aaron, and obviously I'm looking at the stats. I'm following their releases from afar. You know, I click on their releases. They're a team of interest. I read their press releases from their games. But you got your leading home run guy, tied for the lead in home runs, and still third in RBIs in Susak. Well, he's out. You got Garrett Nash, heralded recruit, in his fourth year sophomore, doesn't play, hitting .205, still leads the team in stolen bases.
Yeah, he's back now. He's playing center field, leading off for most of the time.
Okay, so he's back, but he's hitting, you know, .205 with a .347 on base. Still leading the team in stolen bases. It's not an offensive juggernaut, but it seems like they get just enough. And is Carter Bell the Canadian Darwin Barney?
Yeah, I love that. That's a great comparison. he's a winning ball player like Darwin Barney was, and it's just a lot of fun to talk to. You know, what they do, and John Savage said this pretty well on Friday, they're a frustrating team for opposing pitchers. They've done that, and he said they've done that since he's been in the league. They just drive pitchers crazy. They don't give you anything, and I noticed that watching their approach against Gerrit Cole. They would get the two strikes, and then they would just protect and knock the ball, you know, through the four hole, and you know, they had a really good middle to away approach, and they're getting a lot of balls out over the plate, and they just they take what's given to them, and they don't give you anything.
And they seem like they don't, you know, on the mound, it took a no-hitter from Josh Hosich, it seems like, to beat Trevor Bauer. Trevor Bauer was his usual long-tossing, studly self this weekend. What was it, 15 strikeouts in the game on Saturday? And yet, Josh Hosich, you talked to Josh Hosich after the no-hitter. You know, we've written about, you know, this is a guy who's not throwing a lot of breaking balls. Usually when you dominate in college baseball, you throw some breaking balls. Even if they're reverse sliders like Trevor Bauer, here's a guy dominating an admittedly modest UCLA you know, lineup, but he basically seems like he just did it off the fastball and a little bit of changeups, right?
Yeah, those were mostly it. And, you know, he mixed in the curveball now that he's throwing finally. But I mean, he's got a great fastball, you know. I mean, it'll be 94, 95 pretty consistently. And I mean, it looks like he's just come all the way back. I mean, we always knew this guy had it in him to be a beast. And I think he's finally doing it. He's healthy and he's throwing strikes. And, you know, they've got a really good 1-2 punch there with Sam Gavilio and Josh Hosich. And then, you know, they've got a group of other pitchers behind those guys who they've used in different roles with Ben Wetzler and, You know, certainly Tony Bryant has kind of settled into that closer role, and then Matt Boyd, they've got, they kind of like him now in that the setup role, kind of a long relief moment of truth type role. So I mean, those guys are kind of their key guys on the mound. Haven't even had Taylor Starr, Ryan Duke, like Adam Duke, like we've talked about.
Right.
But they haven't needed them, and you know, it's just it's been remarkable.
And the other thing here, Aaron, is that that bullpen. We know that Pat Casey knows how to use a bullpen. Come the postseason, witness in 06 and 07, and 05, the deployment of Kevin Gunderson as a moment of truth guy, Daniel Turpin and Joe Patterson in those years. He knows how to use a bullpen, and it seems like he's got plenty of arms to work with in that bullpen. In your gut, are Danny Hayes, Kevin Keyes, Jared Norris, is that the middle of a lineup? You know, Parker Berberet, the backup catcher, he's tied for the team lead with four home runs, he's replaced Susak. Do they have enough punch offensively with that, you know, frustrating approach? Do you think they can power their way back to Omaha for the third time and fourth time in 6-7 years?
I think they've got a chance. You know, I mean, and you have to believe at this point that they've got a real good chance to do it, because they're probably going to host a regional and a super regional if they win that. And I like Danny Hayes. I think he's a really good, dangerous left-handed hitter. Nice swing. Kevin Keyes has had a very good year for them, and you know, again, I mean, those guys are solid college guys in the middle. I mean, Norris, Carter Bell, Berberet, I mean, those guys are solid. It's not a powerful team, obviously,
right?
But there's a lot of teams near the top of our rankings that aren't. You know, Texas is similar. Texas doesn't have a lot of power.
Great point.
And they just keep on winning too. So I think this team is pretty similar to Texas. Not maybe the kind of elite pitching that Texas has, but it's obviously very good pitching, and I think their offensive approach is similar.
And then the other question for Oregon State is, can they hold off hard-charging Arizona State? The Sun Devils win a series at home against Stanford. They had their little hiccup, which obviously is understandable. They got swept at Oregon State. But in the rest of Pac-10 play, Arizona State has been a monster. And the Sun Devils, 31-10, 13-5 in the league. And their conference schedule the rest of the way, Aaron, is considerably easier, it seems like. They're at Southern Cal and Washington, but those are teams where Arizona State has a significant talent advantage, and then they're going to be home to UCLA. Can Arizona State catch Oregon State despite the fact they got swept, or do you think Oregon – and I guess the other question is, can both these teams be top eight national seeds? Because it feels like they're both easy best eight teams in the country for me.
Yeah, they are right now at least, and – you never know what can happen in the last few weeks, but it seems like they're both on track to be national seeds. And, I do think Oregon State's schedule isn't terribly difficult either. I mean,
you're right.
They're home for Cal and USC. They've got winnable road series at Washington and at Oregon. That said, I mean, I feel like Arizona State's not going to have any more hiccups at this point. You know, they do this every year. They get into their groove in the second half, and they just seem to take off. And, we don't know for sure that Oregon State isn't gonna trip up at some point with all these injuries that they've had to deal with. I mean, I still wonder about that. But at this point, they've earned the benefit of the doubt. So, but that said, I mean, they're only I think a game or so or a half game up on Arizona State. It's close, the standings. So you never know. It's still pretty open.
Looks like with Arizona State, do you get the sense that they're starting to find that groove a little bit offensively, or are they still kind of fighting themselves offensively? It seems like pitching wise. Oh, pitching depth would be the biggest advantage that Oregon State has over Arizona State, correct?
Maybe so. I mean, you know, Arizona State's staff is fairly deep. They've got their guys on the weekends, and I think they've got a little bit more in the bullpen now around Mitchell Lampson. They like Trevor Williams back there as a setup guy, and Mark Lampson has even emerged a little bit. They've got Alex Blackford. So, I think Arizona State is actually deeper on the mound than they were last year. As far as offensively, I mean, boy, Joey DeMichael has just been the real surprise for them. He had three home runs in that win on Sunday. But the rest of those guys, I mean, they still haven't really hit to their capacity, certainly. I mean, we've talked about it before, Zach McPhee and Zach Wilson, two All-Americans. They're still hitting less than .280, you know. So, I mean, I think there's still time for this team to get better. I don't think it's played its best baseball yet, but it did score some runs against a very good Cal pitching staff this weekend.
Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
I think they're getting close. Yeah,
I think so. It seems like you said, Arizona State seems like it is that team, that program that has a history of finding that gear. at the other end of the Pac-10, well, not the other end, other end of our rankings in the Pac-10, the UCLA haters out there will be happy. The Bruins dropped out of our rankings this weekend after losing a series. I forget who they lost a series to. Oregon State, I'm sorry. That's kind of obvious. And Stanford losing that series to Arizona State, as we just talked about. The Cardinal drop out of our rankings. Aaron, right now we have three Pac-10 teams in the rankings, the two we already talked about, and Cal all the way down at 20. Is this still a five-bid league? Is there a six-bid league in this league? If this is all assuming Arizona State is eligible. Can you even conceive of a 64-team field without six Pac-10 teams? Still feels like a six-team league.
Yeah, it is. I think it's still a six-team league. And, you know, I still think Arizona's in fine shape, especially after sweeping Southern Cal. We thought about bringing Arizona back into the rankings this week, in fact. But the fact that they're, you know, they did lose a head-to-head series against UCLA, and their body of work hasn't been great. They did. Then again, they also won a series against Cal. So, you know, I mean, Arizona's going to be there, and I think Stanford's with the strength of their schedule, assuming they don't fall apart down the stretch, they should be in as well. But, you know, right now Stanford's 6-9 in the league and just five games over 500 overall. They've got some work to do, but, you know, and the schedule remaining is kind of middle of the road. I mean, they've got Washington at Oregon, and then they've got Arizona and at Cal. So it's a tough finishing stretch. So Stanford, I think, is in a little bit of a precarious spot, but I think at the end they'll be there, and I think it'll be a six-bid league.
UCLA, you've seen a lot of the Bruins this year because of Colin Bauer. You wrote a great draft blog post the other day about Garrett Cole, his recent struggles. We talked about it last week on the podcast about how, in my mind, comparing Garrett Cole to Strasburg prior, these other great guys that he has similar stuff to, it really the difference is fastball command, is it not, Aaron? I mean, especially comparing him to Steven Strasburg. Steven Strasburg put the fastball in a teacup if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think that is the big difference. Is right now, you know, Garrett Cole isn't really owning the inside half of the plate. That, to me, stood out as the biggest reason why he was struggling this weekend. And, you know, and John Savage kind of agreed. I mean, it's the hitters were too comfortable going the other way, leaning out over the plate and over the, you know, down and away on that slider because he wasn't, you know, when he tried to come inside, he hit a guy. That was the big difference. You know, like you said, Strasburg really commanded the inside part of the plate. Strasburg commanded the zone as well as anybody has in college baseball in a long, long time. That's why he was so special.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you can give the pitch grades all you want. I think even the informed fan, and we throw out a lot of grades, and sometimes I think scouts chide us for it, but I mean, the grades come from them. We're not the ones slapping grades on these pitches. But I don't think you can give this guy an 80 fastball when you don't command it. Just like, you know, J.J. Cooper talks about Aroldis Chapman being a 90 fastball. It's ridiculous because Aroldis Chapman doesn't command it. When you go strike out 14 and walk none in a big league game, throwing as hard as Steven Strasburg did, that's an 80 fastball. When you have the velocity, the life, and the command. We talk about it all the time, Aaron. I obsess about this. We talk about it all the time. Garrett Cole does not have the command. Now, does he do anything, in your opinion, mechanically, or with the people you've talked to? Is it a mechanics issue like it was with Matt Perk as far as, you know, obviously he's a left-hander, right-hander, a little bit different. Is there something mechanically that he's doing that's not allowing him to command the ball arm side? Or do you think it's just a matter of mentally him not being aggressive enough with the fastball on the inner half of the plate to right-hand hitters?
I haven't heard anything mechanically that would prevent him from being able to do that. And I will say that, you know, John Savage has made a point to say the other day that his fastball command has gotten a lot better than it used to be, and he's actually commanded the fastball pretty well, he thinks, for most of the year. He certainly has thrown it for strikes. You know, I mean, Savage said he's thrown it for strike about 70% of the time this year. He doesn't have a lot of walks this year, so it's not an issue of control. It is an issue of maybe command within the zone. And, you know, why? I don't know. I mean, I think Garrett Cole certainly doesn't know either. He was extremely frustrated after the game. And, you know, you give the kid a lot of credit, by the way, because so many times we've seen college pitchers in his situation dodge the media after a stretch like this. And he didn't. He faced the media. He was very polite. He was very honest. He tried to answer questions the best he could. And, you know, he just left found himself shaking his head. He didn't have the answers.
I'll tell you what, the command is the only piece of the puzzle that's missing for Garrett Cole, because I'm so impressed just from afar, from having seen him in Omaha last year, from your interactions with him, with the maturity of a guy whose scouts banged on in high school for lacking maturity. I was impressed. That still stood out in your draft blog of the day. Actually reminded me of Sean Gilmartin last year, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you what, I know I'm getting on a tangent. Your Q&A in last week's weekend preview with Sean Gilmartin was so awesome. And I almost just cursed. I was so impressed with Sean Gilmartin dissecting his own problems last year and then dissecting them and addressing them this year. Yeah. And, sometimes you have to remember that these guys are 20, 21 years old, and they have a lot of pressure on them with their draft year. And when guys have draftitis, it's pretty understandable. Hey, Ryan Howard had probably the worst case of draftitis, and he's had a pretty nice big league career. Yeah. So if a guy has a little struggle before the draft, so I think it's important for people not to jump ship on these guys. And I think what you said about Cole, facing that music, owning it, not trying to make excuses for his struggles, speaks volumes for Gerrit Cole. And I'm still buying on Gerrit Cole. I buy that stock. I just am not buying that he's at a level of Strasburg or Pryor. But that doesn't mean he won't be better than those guys down the line. He just hasn't performed like those guys did in college. That's all.
I'm with you. I mean, I think that's a great way to sum it up. I still am absolutely a Gerrit Cole believer. The stuff's too good. The body's too good. The delivery, the makeup, it's all there. And the command isn't that far off. I really think it's going to click for him, and he's going to be pretty special.
Agree. John and Aaron on the Baseball America podcast here at baseballamerica.com. Aaron, we have a couple Twitter questions we'll go ahead and take because I think it's a good entree into the rest of the podcast. Josh, I'm not going to pronounce his last name, Josh D., how are the races for the last national seeds and hosting sites coming? Who do you see getting them? Aaron, I think we talked about, in this week's rankings, top eight. Where did I type them? They're around here somewhere. I thought I had it here. Texas 6, Arizona 8, 7, Florida State 8. Let's address Florida State. We just mentioned Sean Gilmartin. The Seminoles seem to be kind of teetering a little bit, Aaron, because they just hadn't consistently beaten the other top ACC teams. They lost that series to Virginia, lost that series to North Carolina. Pretty big weekend series for the Seminoles to beat Miami, a red-hot Miami team. It's Florida State not only solidifying itself as a host, but are they a top eight national seed for you?
Yes, and I had them in by a hair last week as a national seed.
Right.
And now I feel even better about it. I mean, the fact that they're 3-1 against Florida, and now they've won a series against Miami. You know, those are their two big in-state rivals. To be 5-2 against those two teams is a nice feather in their cap. And they haven't gotten swept at all. You know, they didn't win that series against Virginia, but I believe it was in Charlottesville, and all three games went extra innings. I mean, you can't have a closer series than that.
Right. Right.
I mean, I think they've been really good this year. I think they're a national seed. And, I think Virginia, South Carolina, Florida, Vanderbilt, Oregon State, Arizona State are all pretty obvious. That's six obvious national seeds. I still think Texas A&M and Florida State are probably the other two. Georgia Tech took a step back this week, losing a series at Clemson. They're not a big step back. They're still in the mix. But them and Texas and North Carolina are kind of those three teams that I've got on the periphery right now.
Amazing to me, Aaron, that when you look at the Boyd's World pseudo RPI, obviously the official one will be released tomorrow afternoon, but when you look at the Boyd's pseudo RPI, six of the top 10 teams are ACC teams. I mean, I just think that right there just tells you that the RPI is bull. I mean, six of the top 10 are ACC? Really? Really?
That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense. It just strains credulita, you know, as Cartman would say. I cannot believe it. I cannot believe that's the case. And yeah, North Carolina's up in that list, and obviously they've had a strong year. Miami's up there. Clemson is the sixth team at 10 in those RPIs. And Clemson, with the impressive week, they win that series at home against Georgia Tech. Clemson played a little softer part of its ACC schedule, took care of business in that softer part of the schedule, enters back into the rankings this week at 22. Let's talk a little bit about the Tigers. Aaron, it seems like they have remade their pitching a bit here of late, shuffled the deck chairs a little bit at Clemson, but it's actually worked for them. And in Brad Miller, their shortstop, they probably got the hottest hitter in the whole country.
Yeah, he's been red hot ever since he came back from that hand injury. And I think you said he's hitting, what, over 500 since he got back? Is that what,
He's hitting over 500 since the North Carolina series coming into the weekend. I'm not sure exactly what his body work was for the weekend, but he went 4-for-4 on Friday night. So, and he's only made, you know, he made two errors that night, but he, I think he's made 8, 9, 10 errors for the year, which is a vast improvement, injury or not, to what he did last year when he made 30 plus. So this guy, I'm not sure what kind of draft he's going to be, but he's a great college player right now. In the top five in Clemson's lineup, Aaron, it just, I guess the top six, really, their lineup really stands out to me as an offensive lineup with Henson, Pohl, Miller, Schaefer, Schaus, Lamb, Kaiboom, or Kaboom, as I prefer to say. That's a deep lineup. There's not an easy out in that lineup, really, is there?
Right, and even going beyond that, you know, Chris Epps and Jason Stoltzer, quality, you know, veteran guys, athletic guys who don't give you anything. I mean, it's a classic Clemson team that draws a lot of walks, makes you work. You know, they've got a great offensive approach, and that works. I mean, you know, there's a reason that program has been so successful over the years, and they've been to Omaha a number of times, and you know, it's they could get back there. They really could. I mean, we thought that they were that kind of a team coming into the year when they were somewhere around the top 10 in the rankings. I forget where exactly. But the key was to remake the pitching staff. And, you know, now they've got Dominic Leone going on Fridays, and I think that's the right guy to have there. I mean, he's a really good, you know, competitive college pitcher, quick arm, you know, fastball, breaking ball. You know, and Justin Surratt on Sundays pitched very well, beat Buck Farmer. That's a veteran guy who's been around for a long time now. He's kind of an undersized bulldog type who, you know, he's had some good summers in the Coastal Plain League. He's shown you a lot of potential. He hadn't quite put it all together and to become an impact starter, but looks like he might be the answer now. And they've got Scott Weissman back in the bullpen where he picked up a save on Sunday. So, you know, maybe that's what they needed to figure out what to do with Weissman. That was one thing that was frustrating. They thought he was going to be their Friday guy. It hadn't worked out. Looks like he's found a home in the bullpen.
I think you nailed it. I think finding Scott Weissman's their best arm, and they had to figure out he's not producing. How can we get this guy into a role of success? And he saves both games this weekend on Friday and Sunday, the two games they win. They hold Georgia Tech to 6 hits. And Justin Serrata, I mean, a grad student, a fifth-year guy, getting the job done for them. The way his emergence allows them in a way, or, you know, they don't miss Weissman as much. And, boy, it just seems like that, you know, last year their team really came together when they found a closer in Alex Frederick. And this year, you know, Frederick's still there, and I'm sure he can help them, and I'm sure he'll pitch some productive innings in, like, a setup role. But it just seems like putting Scott Weissman in that role and getting some production out of him has been huge for Clemson, and they've really and they're offensive. They're offensive enough in this environment, in this college baseball environment. They're an offensive team, and they're dangerous. They strike me as a dangerous club, Aaron, and the ACC strikes me as a dangerous league. But 6 out of 10 in the top 10 RPI, that strikes me as some bull. You know, that doesn't seem quite right. It's a Baseball America podcast with John and Aaron. Aaron, who wants to win the Southeastern Conference's Western Division? The answer appears to be nobody.
It's crazy.
The longer this goes in the SEC West, does it make you adjust downward your expectations of SEC teams in the NCAA tournament? I think we all know Vanderbilt, South Carolina, Florida, number one seeds. You know, they could start selling regional tickets right now. You know, they've won a combined 17 games in a row. Those teams are awesome. Georgia's probably going to get in. Nice midweek win against Georgia Tech as well this week. Arkansas, Alabama, Ole Miss, Auburn, Mississippi State, LSU. Who's the most secure team out of those teams to make regionals?
Well, I mean, I think it's Arkansas. I mean, I think they've got the best combination of the overall record is in pretty good shape, and their RPI is, I believe, still really strong.
Yeah,
it's number 23, so you know they're in pretty good shape. Auburn is still number 20 in the RPI, and you know they did not have a good weekend, getting swept by South Carolina, but it's South Carolina. You know, I mean, that's probably what we would have expected to happen. They just need to get some distance between them and 500. They're only 23 and 21 right now. But if they do, then I think they're probably going to be fine. You know, Alabama, I think, has rebounded nicely after a really rough three-week patch. You know, they lost three straight series to Arkansas, Vanderbilt, Tennessee, and Florida. Actually, four straight series they lost.
Oh, man.
But to come back this week and, you know, beat Southern Miss on the road and then, you know, take two out of three at Mississippi State and, you know, all while they've had to deal with all the tornadoes that ripped through Tuscaloosa, really harrowing experience for them.
Great point.
You got to tip your caps to those guys. I mean, that's they showed a lot of character.
I think that's a huge point. I'm really glad you made it because I did not think of it. But that's a tremendous point for Alabama to win a couple of close games. This is not a physical team. This is not a team that impresses. I can tell you, it does not impress scouts or opposing coaches when they go out there. But they're winning. They're pulling games out. It's a pretty huge weekend for Alabama. Their schedule still doesn't make me think they're going to regionals, Aaron. I guess they will, but, I mean, that series this weekend with LSU, boy, that's a big series. I mean, they've got LSU at Auburn and South Carolina left. LSU takes care of business dramatic fashion with the big comeback on Thursday night, sweeps Kentucky. They've still got the at Alabama, Tennessee, at Mississippi State. Still the worst record in the SEC West. How's LSU looking postseason-wise, and how they do that this weekend with that big comeback? What was it, 8 runs in the bottom of the 8th against Kentucky?
Yeah, that was a stunner on Thursday night. They're down 5-1 in the 8th, and all of a sudden they're staring at 4-15 in the league. And then they just got hot, and they got to Alex Meyer, they got to the Kentucky bullpen.
Tell me now, Captain, what you gonna do? I mean, not a good day for the captains.
That's right. So they, I think that was a season-saving inning right there, and they needed to sweep that series. Kentucky is not a good baseball team, and they did it. And so now I think they're back in the mix. I mean, we talked last week about how the schedule opened up for them, you know, and it's Alabama and Mississippi State are on the road. Those are quality teams. Those aren't be easy series, but they are winnable for LSU, and Tennessee at home is sweepable. So, you know, are they back in the regionals right now? I don't know. They might be. We'll see when I sit down and do stock report. Probably what my gut says, they're still 7-14. They're probably still on the wrong side of the bubble, but they're getting a lot closer.
Yeah, it's just tough, very tough to parse the SEC West. It's just not but it's not an easy answer out there. There hasn't been all year, Aaron, and there's not right now.
The answer is there's no elite teams obviously in that division, and that's what we thought coming into the year, and it's borne itself out.
Absolutely, great point. Big 12, real quick, Aaron. Texas A&M, Oklahoma State, Oklahoma. Those four teams, I think we feel are regional teams. When you do stock report, it's going to be tough for you to get a fifth team in from that league, isn't it?
Yeah, last week it was Kansas State was a fifth team, felt pretty good about it. And then they lose 2 games in a row to Oklahoma State. Now there might be, you know, I mean, now they're 8-12 in the league. That's not a great spot to be in. But I still think they'll probably wind up being in. I mean, they're still 28 in the RPI. They're 26-17 overall. And they've got some work to do, you know, and in the conference, I think. There's a precedent for teams that don't have great records in Big 12 play still getting into regionals. I mean, what was Oklahoma State that
they were
year?
Like eight,
I mean,
it's like
something
eight,
like
9-19.
8-19 in Oklahoma as well. The year, I believe the year before that or after that. I think it was the year before that.
Yeah, there's a precedent. You don't have to have a sexy record to get in from the Big 12. You're right.
And it helps that Kansas State has, you know, Missouri coming up. Missouri's played a lot better lately, but they're still in last place, and they're coming to Manhattan. And then they've got New Orleans, which, you know, will hurt their RPI, but those should be 3 wins. And then they've got Kansas to close. I mean, they don't have a lot left that's challenging. So I think Kansas State will probably be that fifth team in the Big 12, and I don't know that there will be a sixth team.
How crucial is it? Oklahoma 18 in the rankings, in the RPI, I should say. Oklahoma State at 24, TCU at 26. There's a winner of the Oklahoma State TCU series next weekend, a non-conference weekend series in May. How huge of a series is that? Are there hosting implications there, or do you think those teams are too far back to get into the hosting discussion?
I think Oklahoma State could still get into the hosting discussion. It seems like TCU is in trouble after losing 2 games midweek now to Oklahoma. It seems like the hosting resume isn't there. But if they get hot, let's say they sweep Oklahoma State, you know, I think they would have to sweep Oklahoma State to get back into this discussion because of the RPI and the fact that they haven't done great in midweek action. They've been okay, but not great. You know, maybe you're right. I mean, maybe TCU could sneak back into it as well. But, yeah, it's a pretty big series.
That just strikes me as a very significant non-conference series at this time of the year. A couple of the things I wanted to touch on, Aaron. We're going to wrap up a tighter podcast today. UConn is back. The Huskies got back in the rankings last weekend, remain in the rankings this weekend. I guess what we moved them up to 20. This is a team that, there are a lot of haters on UConn, but it seems like that talent is really playing itself out. And that's with Matt Barnes losing a game this weekend, correct? And that's also with Elliot Glenn, their senior kind of leading pitcher, presumed Friday starter. He just had a disastrous year. He's missed a month. He comes back. He still gets hit up a little bit this weekend. How's UConn doing it? And if they get into regionals, which we think they will get in, even if it's a large team, they're kind of in that bubble status. How dangerous is UConn? Do you think people are going to sleep on the Huskies as like a 3 seed coming to, like, I don't know, Virginia or potentially North Carolina or something like that? How dangerous do you think the Huskies are?
Yeah, I think that's the 3 or 4 seed that you don't want to see in your regional, because I think they're really dangerous, you know. And right now, they're even without Nick Ahmed, they're multi-talented shortstop.
Completely forgot.
Who suffered a collapsed lung on Monday against Quinnipiac in a collision at first base. But they plugged in Tom Verity there at shortstop, and he's come up with some big hits for him this week. You know, they're a hard-nosed blue-collar Northeast team that has talent. You know, that's not only is it two guys who are going to go in the top half of the first round with Springer and Barnes, but, I mean, we've talked about it before. I love the team's speed. I think that's a real asset for them, especially with these bats. They can manufacture offense with their speed. You know, guys like LJ Mazzilli and John Andreoli and, you know, Springer, of course. I mean, Billy Ferreter, these guys can really run. They've got veterans on the mound in addition to Springer. And, in addition to Barnes. I mean, they've got Greg Napo, who's been around. They've got, you know, Oberg and Vance in the bullpen, veteran guys. I mean, they've got a lot of experience in this team. Van Wart, I mean, other guys, upperclassmen. I think they're dangerous, you know, and they're 30-13. And yeah, I know they struggled in the pre-conference and they've kind of found their groove in the Big East, and the Big East isn't great, but, you know, they've taken care of business. They're in control of the Big East. They swept St. John's. They won 2 out of 3 against Pitt. Those are two of the teams that are in the top part of that league standings. I think Pitt's in second place and St. John's is tied for third. I think they're really good. You know, I still think they're really good. And, you know, I saw them out here in California a couple of times, and my eyes told me that they were good, that they were talented, and they just hadn't clicked yet. And now I think they're getting a lot closer.
I mean, that's a great way to sum it up. And Aaron, I guess the other team that's kind of in this mix is a really difficult team to assess is Stetson. I moved up in our rankings this week. You know, we have Stetson at 15, Fresno at 19. I thought we should touch on both those teams. You know, Stetson, basically, this team's going to have to lose a series to fall out of our rankings or to fall in our rankings. Even the Atlantic Sun's a competitive league this year, maybe not as much pro talent as we've seen in that league in recent years, but it's a very competitive league. Does the Miami series loss give them – do they have more of a chance to host? Do you think that their hosting chances are getting dimmer by the week because their RPI is going to keep coming down as they play in conference?
You know, I had them as a host last week over Miami, and now I still do. I mean, they swept up their series. Miami lost the series. I think if you compare their resume to Miami's, I believe Stetson's got a better record against the top 100.
They have a better RPI right now, according to Boyd. Or not better. They're very comparable. They're like, 13th. It's a very competitive RPI.
Yeah, I mean, they're in pretty good shape, and I think the fact that they're a mid-major, you know, that helps them. If you compare them with Miami, which is in the ACC, is the committee going to give the ACC 5 hosts where you've got another team in Florida that has a comparable resume, that's a mid-major, that hasn't hosted before, that would love to and has a good enough facility to do it? I think they'd rather have Stetson host, even if they they had Stetson as a 2 seed and Miami as the 1 seed, which could happen because of the RPI. I mean, this could be a deal like UConn last year, hosting as a 2 seed. Despite all their wins, their great season, their 47-win season, they were a two seed and Florida State was a one because of the RPI. That could happen with Stetson. They could be a two seed and maybe Miami a number one. But I think Stetson's going to host unless they fall apart here down the stretch.
I'm looking for now I'm looking at Fresno. It's another team that we've had hosting, Aaron, and their RPI is still good. But a series to be completed tonight at home against Hawaii. I thought, again, your weekend preview breakdown of Hawaii was just awesome. Detailing, talk about injuries. They go into the Fresno State series with a backup catcher playing shortstop. I can't get over that. And Colton Wong and company just continuing to get the job done. They win the first two games at Fresno. If Hawaii wins that series, is Hawaii going to be an at-large team now? Can the WAC be a two-bid league, or is their RPI just too low?
You know, they're 107 in the RPI right now. So, which boggles my mind a little bit because they've played a good non-conference schedule. You know, they started up with Oregon, which turned out to not be good. So that's one thing that hurts them. Texas, they played Cal State Fullerton. They went to LMU. You know, they've played a lot of named teams non-conference. They did as much as they could have done to scheduling. And you know, and Mike Trapasso was kind of bemoaning it a little bit last week when I talked with him, just because it doesn't matter what they do. They just can't get the RPI to work in their favor out there, you know, and it's frustrating for him. But they're probably not going to be an at-large, you know, and if they win this series, it looks like they're in pretty good shape to maybe get that automatic bid. They probably would wind up being the number one seed in the WAC tournament. You know, you still have to like Fresno's chances. I still think Fresno's the best team in that league. But, you know, if they lose 3 out of 4 at home to Hawaii, then it's hard to make that case all of a sudden. So, you know, I think that if Fresno does not win the automatic bid, it'll be a two-bid league. Otherwise, you're probably looking at just Fresno.
That's a good point. Burt Granger asked us on Twitter. We discussed Clemson. He said, please discuss Clemson, TCU, and UConn as preseason top tens that stumble out of the gate appear to have righted the ship. We've discussed UConn. We've discussed Clemson. TCU, Aaron, do you feel like TCU's righted the ship? Or do you feel like TCU is still trying to figure out? I mean, it seems like they from afar, and you're more plugged in than I am, seems like they're still trying to figure out their Brian Holiday. They're trying to figure out their post-Brian Holiday identity a little bit. It feels like Kyle Winkler is the undisputed guy on this team and the number one guy, and their upside still seems pretty high if Matt Perk comes back, you know, and can be Matt Perk again. But there are no guarantees there. Talk a little bit about the Horned Frogs before we sign off.
You know, they have only lost one series all year, and that was against Cal State Fullerton early on.
No shame there.
And they have dominated the Mountain West the way that we expected them to, the way that they needed to. And they've actually done better in midweek games against good teams than they did last year when they really had a lot of trouble with those Big 12 teams. They did beat Texas A&M last week midweek. You know, they've got a win against Texas State, and you know, they've done okay. Win against Baylor earlier on, but and also they played Big 12 teams in weekend series earlier this year. They took 2 out of 3 against Kansas. They swept at Texas Tech. You know, they've done a good job. I think they put together a nice body of work. It does seem like they're fighting it more than they were last year. That the season's been more of a grind for them, and not just because of Perk, but you know, they've. The pitching depth, I think, isn't where it was last year. For sure, it's not.
Right.
You know, we thought coming into the year that Schlossnagel was worried coming into the year about their bullpen a little bit. You know, that was his major concern with this team. He thought Eric Miller was going to have to be the closer, and that did not work out. It was a disaster. But now they've moved Eric Miller into that, you know, this weekend starter role in place of Perk, and he's pitched well for 2 weeks in a row now. He's got a very good arm. And you know, if he's coming around, that's good news for them. They still have two, you know, quality guys with Winkler and Maxwell. Andrew Mitchell's been outstanding as a freshman. They like him now in that midweek role where they play all those quality midweek games. But the bullpen depth is still a little bit of an issue. You know, and that's made it hard for them. They've had to move guys around. I mean, we saw it last week when they played Monday and Tuesday. They had to pitch a guy on Monday against Dallas Baptist who they were planning on redshirting.
Right.
You know, it's pitching depth is not there, and I think that hurts them. They're certainly not as offensive as they were last year. They're not as physical, you know, without Holiday and Matt Curry, but they've scored enough runs. I still think they're dangerous, but I don't think necessarily they're as good of a team as they were last year.
almost seems like I haven't mentioned Matt Curry this year, but it almost seems like they miss him more in some ways than Holiday.
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't go that far. Holiday was the heart and soul of that team.
I know, but I mean, in terms of production, you know, Josh Elander's a pretty decent player. He plays a pretty prominent role in their team. If they really, maybe it's just the bats. That doesn't seem like they have a masher in the middle of that lineup like they had with Matt Curry.
Yeah, I mean, and Brian Holiday had a huge year offensively last year too. Both those guys were their two best offensive players last year. And they're both gone. And you know, Holiday was also a catcher and, you know, like, again, the leadership and the defense and all that
heart
stuff.
And soul, right.
That's right. But you know, they missed both those guys. There's no question. And they missed the seniors that they had in the bullpen. They could mix and match you last year and had a lot of options back there. They missed Caleb Merck, who should have been their closer this year before he was lost to Tommy John surgery. So there's some things you can point to. I think you got to give those guys credit for being 31 and 13, given the injuries and the situation that they've had.
I'm saying all those things. I was about to say they're 15-2 in their league, and they're 31-3. It's pretty impressive. So we could probably talk more, Aaron. Impressive win in Conference USA for Southern Miss on the road, solidifying themselves as the top team in that league.
We should touch on that before we go. I mean, I think that's a pretty significant series for Southern Miss, like you said, going on the road. I mean, that's I think clearly the best team in Conference USA. I mean, I'm really impressed with them. Again, it seems like their Omaha team a couple of years ago with a lot of veteran older guys, you know, the Mark Bourgeois types. I mean, he's had a great year as a physical. It seems like every weekend I'm looking at the box scores and that guy's got a big hit or a big home run for them, or you know, four RBIs like he had Saturday. It's a very physical older lineup, and even without Todd McGinnis this weekend, they've gotten great pitching from Jonathan Thompson on Saturday through a complete game shutout, and you know, Jeffrey Thomas, I believe, pitched very well on Friday, and they've got a great closer at the back. I mean, this team's dangerous. I like Southern Miss.
I like Southern Miss as well. They're physical. They're experienced. They, even with Volmuth a little bit hurt, he's DHing. He still provides power in the middle of their lineup. They are a dangerous team. Southern Conference, real quick. Georgia Southern getting swept at UNC Greensboro. That was a shocker, I think, to both of us. But Elon, College of Charleston, UNC Greensboro, all three of these teams are very hot. Elon, seems like they've got a very good shot at an at-large bid if they don't win the league. Charleston, I think the next most likely team is Samford in this mix at all. Their RPI is not that different from Charleston's. Is this a two-bid league, three-bid league? I mean, obviously you can explore this a little bit deeper with this week's stock report. What's your gut on the SoCon? How many other multi-bid leagues are there?
You know, I think it's probably a two-bid league if you like College of Charleston. And I like their talent, and I like the fact that they've been playing better, and they're getting themselves back onto the bubble, you know, in that range. I think they're number 60 now or so in the RPI,
right.
maybe even a little bit better than that. But you know, they're 30-15 overall. I mean, you can make a case for them. I think Elon is the only one that can feel safe right now. I don't expect. I mean, Samford, they're in fifth place in the league. They haven't really won the series against the best teams they've played. You know, they lost a series last week to Greensboro. Greensboro is hot right now, you're right, but their RPI is not going to get it done. I think it's Elon, and I think Georgia Southern blew its chance this weekend. You know, they were already kind of on the periphery because of the RPI. Getting swept by Greensboro was a killer. So I think it's Elon and maybe College of Charleston, but you could see this as a one-bid league this year. It's, you know, this league is something like number 13 in the conference RPI, which is lower than it usually is. You know, it's not necessarily a two or three-bid league like it usually is.
I agree with you. I personally think that second bid is going to come down to Charleston and Samford the last weekend of the season. Samford's RPI isn't that far behind Charleston's, and they still have a game with Auburn and a game with Troy that'll help their RPI. So, we'll see. They've got to obviously take care of business on the field, but a win against Auburn this week did not hurt the Bulldogs' chances. And I'm just going to throw out there, you know, it's a time of year for job speculation. You know, we know of one job that's open, two, I guess, North Carolina A&T, which is not a job people will seek. And I'm very sorry to see Keith Shoemate resign there, but I understand why he wants, he's a white coach at an HBCU. and he wants an African American to be the coach at an HBCU, and that's why he's leaving. I think Keith Shumay will do great wherever he wants to go. He's a Jack Leggett protege, and he's in that school. I bet you he'll wind up as an assistant coach at a good school and make three times as much money. Southern Cal is a big job opening out there. It's not as useless to speculate about it right now because it's just speculation. But, we don't even know if Frank Cruz will be kept. He's the interim head coach there. They just got swept this weekend by Arizona. That doesn't bode well for the Trojans. They're under 500. But if you're a team looking at young mid-major head coaches who are upwardly mobile, I'm telling you about Casey Dunn, who played at Auburn, whose dad is a legendary high school baseball coach and out in the state of Alabama. By legendary, I don't mean he didn't really exist. He's like King Arthur. I mean legendary in that he has a very big reputation. So it's really legendary is the wrong word to use. But Samford's if Samford goes to regionals this year, that guy's going to be a head coach in the SEC somewhere. That's my considered opinion. That's one thing to watch in the Southern Conference. That's a cradle of coaches who move on to other jobs historically.
Yeah.
And that's one that's an upwardly mobile one. Any other league, Aaron? Is the Atlantic Sun a multi-bid league? The Sun Belt? Are these multi-bid leagues, you think?
Yeah.
Possibly, for sure?
I think both those leagues probably will be. Jacksonville's on the bubble. I mean, that's a potential two-bid league. Right now, I had Jacksonville in last week. I think the Sun Belt is a safer bet to be two- or three-bid league. Florida International really helped itself this weekend with a series sweep, and they're playing well right now, and that was a team coming into the year that I think we had as the favorite in the Sun Belt, and they're starting to play like it. And FAU, another team that we had in last week but on the bubble, really helped itself with a series win against Troy. So, I think those three teams in the Sun Belt, I think that's probably a three-bid league.
Great stuff, Fitzy. Too much fun talking to try to smush all that into 30 minutes. We both got meetings to do and work to do, calls to make, people to see. So let's get back to that. But great takes from you this week. And thank everybody for the questions on Twitter and on Facebook. And we will see you next Monday on the next Baseball America College podcast. I also want to remind people, I believe now it can be told, that next Sunday, May 8th, will be the debut of the Baseball America show on XM Sirius satellite radio. Aaron, you want to be a guest next Sunday night?
Is this an official invitation?
It's an official invite. I'm extending the invite. You could be our guest.
I'm there.
Sunday night seems like a good time to have you on to talk a little college baseball on Sirius XM, I think is what I'm supposed to say. And we also remind people that Baseball America has all of our 2011 books are available. Get your copy while supplies last. I know we're already short on Prospect Handbook copies, but you can get the Prospect Handbook, the Almanac, the Directory, the Draft Almanac, the Super Register, all at baseballamerica.com/store. So for Aaron Fitt, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.